Our speaker tonight is someone who is known as a master teacher and extraordinary lecturer. Joan Stiles received her PhD from Princeton University in 1983 and came immediately to UCSD, recognizing this is where the action is and the place to be. She's been here ever since. A decade ago, Joan founded the program in Human Development Program, which has been an extraordinary success. It's one of the largest undergraduate majors at UCSD. Those of you in the audience who are high school students and thinking about coming to UCSD, look for the HDP, the Human Development Program. And 5 or 6 years ago, she founded and is currently director of the Center for Human Development. Joan is what's called a developmental cognitive neuroscientist. It's a mouthful, but basically what it means is she studies how the brain develops from infancy through childhood and into adolescence and adulthood. How the brain develops and how the developing brain then behaves. That is the cognition, the mind. Joan's interests are many. She has studied, among other things, the way our brains understand the world as it comes into us through our eyes. It's called spatial cognition. Has made seminal foundational discoveries in this area. She's also interested in not only typically developing populations, but atypically developing populations. Precisely, more specifically, infants who have suffered stroke around the time of birth. Tonight she'll talk to us about what's a long-standing and fascinating issue, which is the interaction between nature and nurture, the role between the relationship between biology and experience. I ask you to join me in welcoming Joan Stiles.
Thank you, Jeff, for that very kind introduction. I want to begin by thanking the sponsors of this lecture series. I know it has been wildly successful, and I hope I can contribute tonight. We'll see. I'd also like to thank the museum for offering us this venue to hold these lectures. What I'd like to talk to you tonight about is a little bit about how we've been thinking about the developing brain. The adult human brain is arguably the most complex of all biological systems. This picture shows the side of an adult human brain. It's made up of 100 billion information processing cells. These cells are called neurons. The neurons communicate with each other by making connections. The connections are called synapses. It's estimated that there are 60 trillion connections in the adult brain. Now, those kinds of numbers are staggering. They're really quite hard to grasp. And there's lots of analogies out there to try to give us a handle on the kinds of numbers that we're talking about when we talk about the cells in the brain or the connections between them. What I particularly like is that the number of neurons is comparable to all of the trees in the Amazon rainforest, and that the number of connections is comparable to all of the leaves on all of the trees in the Amazon rainforest. Okay. That's a lot of material that we're trying to put together across brain development. The networks of connections among neurons create complex brain systems that control all of our actions, perceptions, feelings, and thoughts. If we look at the brain from other angles, that is, other angles than the one you see here, we can appreciate more of its structure. I'm sure you know that there are two sides of the brain, the right and the left hemisphere. And if you look down at the brain from the top, you can see that the hemispheres are relatively separate. They're connected by a big fiber bundle that lets the two sides of the brain talk to each other. What's remarkable is that for all of this complexity, the average human brain weighs about 3 pounds, and it makes it a structure that fits rather neatly into an average and sometimes not so average human skull. Given the remarkable nature of the mature human brain, a question that has intrigued scientists for many, many years is, how does the brain develop? The question of how the brain develops is really two questions. The first is, how does the structure of the brain develop? That is, how does this complex structure, the one you see right here, develop from this most primitive brain structure? The structure is called the neural tube. The neural tube forms in the first weeks of pregnancy and will develop into the mature brain. Getting from the neural tube to the mature brain requires a lot of development. There's a lot of stuff that needs to be produced. And one thing to notice is that these two slides are not to scale. The actual size of the neural tube, there's a dot there. I don't know if you can see it, so I put a red circle around the dot. But the actual size is about 2 millimeters. It's about the size of a grain of sand. So the first important question about brain development concerns how the complexity of the structure of the mature human brain emerges from this tiny initial structure. But the second question concerns the functions of the brain. How does the functional organization of the brain develop? That is, how does the developing brain go from this very primitive system of the embryo to the simple and yet elaborate system that supports the basic sensory and motor abilities of the newborn? And yes, that's my daughter, Annie, at one day. And how does she go from the newborn state to the state of a young adult that is one with complex and sophisticated abilities? Okay. That is, someone who is capable of selecting these very fashionable sunglasses and yet also proudly sports a not-so-fashionable fish hat. Okay. I, by the way, do have permission to use this picture. I called and asked. Okay. For most of the remainder of this talk, I'd like to try to examine some of these questions about the hows of development. How do the structures emerge? How does the functional organization of the brain arise? But in order to talk about development, it's probably important to say a few more things about the adult brain. What is it made of, and how is it organized? To do that, let's first take a look at the inside of a brain. Now, if I were to cut the brain along that red dotted line, there aren't really red dotted lines in the brain, but if I were to cut it along that red dotted line and turn the back section so that it faced you, this is what you'd see. Okay? So what is it that we see when we begin to look inside the brain? Well, first we see two kinds of tissue. We see gray matter and we see white matter. Gray matter, besides being the stuff that lecture series are made of, although we choose to use the American spelling and the lecture series is using the British spelling, there's gray matter and there's white matter. Gray matter is so called because it looks gray, well named. And it looks gray because it contains the cell bodies of the information processing cells of the brain. That is, it contains the cell bodies of the neurons. Now, let's take a minute to look a little bit more closely at this cross-section of the brain. If you look at along the margin of the brain, there's a thin strip of gray matter that runs along the entire surface. That's the neocortex. Cortex is a Latin word meaning bark, as in the bark of a tree. So the cortex is a thin rind or mantle that lies on the surface of the brain. This is an important structure that first appeared in mammals and is responsible for carrying out all the sensory, perceptual, motor, and higher cognitive functions that we engage in every day. The deeper pockets of gray matter are called the nuclei. They act as relay stations, conveying information to the neocortex from the outside world or sending signals from the cortex to the rest of the body. Now, if the gray matter is the cell bodies of neurons, what's the white matter? The white matter consists of the fibers that connect neurons into information processing networks. Each neuron extends a connecting fiber called an axon. Axons are covered with a fatty substance called myelin. That gives the axons their white appearance. Myelin acts like the insulation on an electrical wire, making the conductions of signals between neurons fast and efficient. At the end of the axon are connection sites called synapses. They allow the cells to communicate with one another. Now, let's look for a moment at two neurons that are hooking up. And for those of you in the audience who are younger than I am, I want you to know that doesn't mean they're going to be dating. What it means is that they're going to be making a connection. Okay. So what you see here is the axons from two neurons approaching each other. They approach each other, and then they connect. Now, remember that there are 60 trillion connections in the brain, so that means after this connection that you see, that's one down, 59,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999,999 it seems like it's making multiple connections, but it's really only making one. Okay, now that we've taken a look at the inside of the brain and taken a look at the building blocks, that is the neurons and connections, and we've seen that there are billions of cells that are needed to form the organized information processing pathways of the brain, it must be apparent that surely all of this complex organization can't be haphazard. There must be more organization in the cortex itself. Now, let's look again at the surface of the brain. Now that you know that what's on the surface is the neocortex, let's consider what the structure of the neocortex is. Now, just looking at the surface of this brain right here, it appears to be pretty uniform. That is, from one area to the next, it looks to be pretty much the same. But if you examine different areas of the cortex under a microscope, the differences become available. I mean, become apparent. They're not colored. This is just, you know. What this is a colored version of a map that was actually made in the early 1900s by a neuroscientist by the name of Brodmann. Brodmann identified 47 different sub-areas within the human neocortex. What he identified was different kinds of cells that differ in the kinds of input they receive and in the kinds of output they send. And each one of these areas is quite distinct from one another in those terms. For example, if we look at back here, this is the back of the brain, other side's the front of the brain, what you see here is an important visual area. This is primary visual cortex. It's the first place that information from the eye reaches the brain. A little further forward, we see an area that's responsible for hearing. That's the auditory cortex. There's also two important language areas that I'd like to point out because we'll have some more to say about that later. In the front of the brain, there's an area that is responsible for processing of speech production. So when you talk, it's the part of the brain that is active. When you understand language, that is, when you engage in speech comprehension, a different area of the brain is most active. Now, these two speech areas are heavily connected and interact with each other, but those are two areas that are primarily responsible for conducting those functions. All of those areas are important for basic functioning, but the regions rarely operate alone. Rather, they operate as part of complex information processing pathways. Now, what you're looking at here is the underside of the brain. It's as though I've taken the brain and turned it upright. The front of the brain is at the top of the picture, and you can tell that because that's where the eye is. And the bottom of the brain is the back of the brain is at the bottom of the picture, and you can tell that because that's where primary visual cortex is, and we just talked about where that was. Now, in between these two structures, that is, between the eye and primary visual cortex, there are a whole bunch of other structures. Now, you don't have to look and see what all those are. Just notice how many of them there are. And these structures form a pathway that leads from the eye back to the back of the brain. Okay, so, and damage to different parts of this pathway, any different part of this pathway, can seriously disrupt vision. Okay, now that you know about all the basic parts of the adult brain, let's go back and think about how they might develop. So, there are 100 billion neurons in the brain, that's a lot, and it's a lot especially since almost all the neurons that make up the adult brain, almost, are generated during the first half of pregnancy, during the first half of gestation. What that means is that in order to generate enough neurons to make up the human brain, neurons during pregnancy need to be produced at the rate of approximately 200,000 per minute during early pregnancy. So that means that there's a lot of brain development that must be happening during the prenatal period. And as shown by this famous figure from developmental neurobiologist Max Cowan's now classic article in Scientific American, by Max Cowan was actually director of the Salk Institute in La Jolla for many years. What you can see here in this depiction of brain development during the prenatal period is that there's a lot of change from that early structure that I showed you at the very beginning of the talk to the structure of the brain of the neonate. But at birth, brain development is far from complete. Brain development is a protracted process that extends through childhood and into adolescence. We talked about the production of a lot of things in the brain, 100 billion neurons, most in less than 5 months, 60 trillion connections. As staggering as these numbers are, what's even more amazing is that infants, newborn babies, but babies who are in the first year of life, initially have nearly twice as many cells in their brain, twice as many neurons in their brain as an adult does, and they've got nearly twice as many connections in their brain. This massive overproduction of both neurons and connections means that some very important aspects of brain development must involve the loss or pruning back of both neurons and connections between neurons. Indeed, some of Cowan's very important contributions to the field of developmental neurobiology concern some of these somewhat counterintuitive postnatal events. So let's look at some of the data on the overproduction and pruning back of connections in the brain. The hallmark of both pre- and postnatal brain development are cycles of overproduction of connections followed by loss of connections. This is illustrated in this example from work of the neurologist Peter Huttenlocher. These are data from humans. This graph charts the change in development from the prenatal period indicated. Indicated in this range, through the first year of life, through childhood, and on into adulthood. So age is graphed here. What's graphed along here are the number of connections in a constant volume of cortex. What you should notice is that in the prenatal period, there are very few connections in the brain. There are some. The brain is functioning prenatally, but the number of connections is comparatively small. There's a large spike in production during the first year of life, such that the number of connections in the brain, this is primary visual cortex, by the way, after the first year of life, the number of neurons connections in primary visual cortex is nearly twice that of the number in an adult brain. After that, we see that there's a tapering off until we eventually reach the adult level of connections within the brain. Now, these are the data from, as I said, from primary visual cortex, but the pattern of overproduction and loss of connections is the same in all regions of the brain. The timing is just a little different. For example, in the frontal cortices in the front of the brain, which are problem-solving regions, the peak of connectivity comes at about age 5. So it rises and then declines. So the timing of peak connectivity is different in different areas of the brain, but the pattern of overproduction and loss is consistent. Okay, a similar pattern of overproduction and loss is observed for neurons. Many, many more neurons are produced early in development than are apparent in the adult brain. The process of cell death happens a little earlier than does the process of overproduction and loss of connections, mostly in the prenatal and early postnatal period. The cell death that one observes is not a pathological process. Most of the cells that die are not abnormal. They haven't been injured. So why do so many cells die in the normal course of brain development? There are a number of reasons, but the main reason concerns the cell's ability to become part of information processing networks, that is, making connections with other cells and sending and receiving signals. This is important because only cells that are part of functioning networks have access to important substances called nerve growth factor, which is essential for the survival of cells. When cells can't get nerve growth factor, they die. What you've been watching are three cells competing for resources. Now, this is a tape loop. So the cell that you see over here on the left, it's not being resurrected. So once the cell dies, it dies. Anyway, you've been watching three cells that are competing for resources. The two on the right win the connection, and the one on the left dies off. That's the process of competition. The cells that make successful connections survive, and the ones that don't die. These two examples, that is cell death and the removal of connections, illustrate the dynamic processes that underlie the development of the complex anatomy of the brain. But equally, it's equally important to consider how these changes in anatomy can support function, that is, behavior, the sensory, motor, perceptual, cognitive, social activities that are an essential part of development. To any mom or dad out there, this is not going to be a big surprise. The function of the organism begins very early. It begins in the prenatal period. And so what we see is this developing structure, even in the prenatal period, beginning to support the functions of organisms. In the movie that I'll show you right now, what you're seeing, this is an image of a 30-week-old fetus in utero, taken in utero. The fetus is moving and interacting with his surroundings. You'll see hand-to-face movements. You see a lot of leg movement. The film is from a very large study of prenatal development by Daniela Preyer at the Medical University of Vienna in Austria. They do this work in order to provide a measure of viability of fetuses before they're born. But importantly for us, what you can see is that prenatally there's a lot of activity, a lot of function that goes on that's associated with these developments that we've been talking about in the structure of the brain. And this is obviously just the beginning. The extensive data on perceptual, cognitive, and social development through childhood and into adolescence define the importance of trying to understand the relationship between the development of brain structure and its function. And it's a very big question. It, in fact, leads to the central question about brain development, which is, how does the brain develop? Are the processes that underlie brain development innate? That is, are they biologically predetermined? Or are they emergent? Are they influenced by experience? In phrasing the question this way, by asking it as an either-or question, we see the roots of what is perhaps one of the oldest philosophical debates around. That is, the debate over nature versus nurture. It is a debate that has been central in both the field of biology and psychology. In psychology, the question has been, where does knowledge come from? How does the child come to know about the world? What is the origin of knowledge? In biology, the question centers around the issue of inheritance. How does one account for both intergenerational constancy and for differences in individuals? Does genetic information play an exclusive role in development, or does experience play a role as well? These had been the debates in these fields for many, many years. However, recent advances in our understanding of the basic processes of brain development suggest that this very old question may very well be the wrong question. That is, the right question about development is not nature versus nurture, not nature or nurture, but rather the interaction of the two. That is, the combination. How do nature and nurture interact in ways that are essential for development? Now, let me be clear, both sides in the nature-nurture debate, proponents on both sides will say, of course, the other side's important. Nativists will say babies must learn something. And those who take a strongly environmentalist view suggest that, well, the genes must be doing something. But each side gives priority to one factor over the other. Each side argues that either innate factors or experience of the organism is somehow more fundamental, more important to development than the other. Recent work, however, suggests that from the beginning of brain development, nature, that is genetic factors, and nurture, that is the environment or experience of the organism, interact with each other flexibly and dynamically in what Harvard neuropsychologist Chuck Nelson has called a subtle but orchestrated dance that occurs between the brain and the environment. Brain development is an orderly but flexible process. The basic plan of the brain is governed by genetic expression, but influenced at every point along the way by the experience of the organism. Brain development is, in other words, plastic. Brain development is a dynamic event. New structures build on earlier ones, and the development of new structures requires an interaction between intrinsic factors, that is the genes, and extrinsic factors, that is the environment. This leads to two questions then. The first, what are genes and what do they do? And second, how can the environment influence biological development? First, let's begin with the question of what are genes? I think you've heard some talks about this before by some eminent geneticists here. But very simply, genes are segments of DNA molecules. Each DNA molecule has two strands. A piece of DNA molecule is shown here. They are linked together and coiled into the famous double helix structure that Nobel Prize-winning biologists Watson and Crick described in 1953. We like to call them Crick and Watson because Francis Crick was at the Salk Institute in La Jolla for many years. Anyway, if we look closer at a segment of DNA, we can see that the basic units of the genes, which are called base compounds, are shown right here. Each base compound is like a letter in the alphabet of the genetic code. The alphabet has four letters, the four that you see there, that combine in sequences of different lengths, and each one of these sequences constitutes a gene. Some genes have only a few letters, and some genes are very long. The information in the gene is exactly and no more than the information in the ordered sequences of base compounds. The sequences provide a template that can be copied. And when that template of a particular sequence of base compounds gets copied, that's what we call gene expression. Okay, so that's what genes are. So what do they do? In the press, on television, we hear a lot about the discovery of genes for different things. But given the genes for language, genes for artistic talent, genes for lots of things. But given what I've told you about what genes are, let's think about what some of those claims must mean and how we need to interpret them. First of all, what about genes for things like artistic talent and language? Well, there's no specific gene for either artistic talent or language. What about genes for disease? Well, kind of. I mean, they're certainly genes associated with diseases, but are there genes typically for a disease? One gene? No. What about genes for eye color? Surely there must be something as simple as eye color could have one gene. Well, no, it turns out that that's more complicated as well. Now, to be clear, genes are absolutely essential for all of these things. There are genes associated with all of these processes. Genes are essential for the development of all biological and behavioral processes, but it is very rare for one gene to be solely responsible for the development of any particular structure or function. Rather, many genes, working in concert with each other and often influenced by input from the environment, direct the development of each of these processes that you see here. Okay. What genes do is to provide a template for making proteins. Proteins are the principal constituents of cells. They carry out the major biological functions of the cell. They interact with one another, causing chains of biological events that are necessary for, among other things, brain development. Now, at this point, perhaps an example would be helpful. Okay, what I'd like to talk about now here is an example of the importance of genes in setting up the areas of the neocortex. We talked about the areas of cortex before when I showed you the Brodmann slide. How is it that those areas come into being? Two important genes in setting up the very most primitive organization of the neocortex are two genes called PAX6 and EMX2. If you don't like those names, you can call them Paul or Eric if you like. They're just genes and they have names. These genes are expressed in different amounts in different parts of the primitive cortex. Depending on the particular combination of these two genes and the signals they create, different cortical areas are formed. The two genes are expressed in the embryonic neocortex region very early in development, in the second month of pregnancy. What you see here, just to orient you to what this is, in the small cutout above, is to show you that we're looking down on the surface of the primitive neocortex, a little like looking down on the surface of the mature brain. EMX2 is expressed in greater concentrations in the back and middle regions of the brain. PAX6 is expressed in greater concentrations in the front and side regions of the brain. The two expression gradients compete each suppressing the other. Okay? The different combinations of gene concentrations signal the cells in those regions of the cortex to take on different functional roles. High EMX2 and low PAC6 combinations signal cells to become visual cortex. That is the region that you see in red. High PAC6, low EMX2 combinations signal cells to become a motor cortex, the cortex that controls movement. That's indicated in blue. Intermediate levels of both genes signal cells to become sensory, that is responding to touch and feeling, and that's indicated in green. This work, and I think I forgot to say this, comes out of the laboratory of Dennis O'Leary at the Salk Institute in La Jolla, has been very important in telling us how the very early patterning of the neocortex begins to emerge. O'Leary's lab has also shown us what happens if one of these two genes are defective. So this is what you just saw before, the normal pattern of gene expression and the normal emergence of areas in the brain. But what happens if the EMX2 gene is abnormal? If there's a gene mutation that considerably lowers the amount of gene expression for EMX2, what we see here is that the expression of the competing gene, the PAC6 gene, moves further back of the cortex, and you see a corresponding movement of the functional brain areas. So now, most notably in this figure, the red areas have contracted tremendously, and the blue and green areas have expanded. A similar story is observed when we look at mutations of the PAC6 gene. When the PAC6 gene is mutated, is defective, then what we see is a shift in the areas forward. So now the PAC6 gene is no longer expressing sufficient quantities in the frontal areas of the brain, and we see the areas of the cortex shifting forward. Okay, so the varying concentrations of these two genes operate together to create these different cortical areas. These kinds of studies demonstrate the importance of intrinsic patterning, that is gene expression, in setting up the basic organization of brain areas. But the patterns you see here are not complete. Other factors further direct and shape the emerging organization of the brain. Let's consider next the role that experience plays in the developing organization of the brain. Earlier, we discussed the fact that the neural elements, cells and connections, are overproduced in the brain and then pruned back. Young brains form many more connections than are required, and the environment, the experience of the child, plays an essential role in determining which of those cells and connections will be stabilized and retained and which will be lost. Basic patterning is established by the genes, but it's imprecise. The experience of the child shapes and directs the final organization of the brain. Experience is essential for the emergence of normal brain organization, and it allows for significant adaptation and flexibility in brain organization when development is abnormal. Okay, let's consider the effects of different kinds of experience on brain development. I want to begin first with a study. These studies were actually done with rats, but they apply to humans as well. This is a study by William Greeno at the University of Illinois. He's done a number of important studies on the effects of environmental complexity on brain development. Bill Greeno raised young rat pups or mature adult rats in either impoverished conditions or in enriched conditions. The impoverished conditions was a standard rat cage. The animals were one group of animals were housed individually, one rat per cage, in an isolate cage like this one. They were given food and water, but there were no activities, no input, and importantly, no companions. So they were raised in this kind of isolate condition. Contrast this environment with the environment that the other group of rats were raised in. Okay. This is actually real. I have to thank Bill Greeno for this slide. I asked him to send me a picture of one of his environments, and this really was one of the environments that they used. There's lots of interesting toys. There's lots of places to go. There's lots of things to do. You see the rat right there. Lots of friends, dozen or so companions in here, and importantly, lots of attentive and compliant graduate students who came in every day and rearranged things, added new toys, and generally kept the thing interesting. The animals were placed in the environments as young pups or as adults, as middle-aged, middle-aged rats. And then they were left there for varying amounts of time, up to approximately 55 days. The different rearing conditions had a dramatic impact on the number of connections in the brains of the animals. Let's first consider the young animals. These are data from two groups of animals, one reared in the isolate cages, one reared in the complex environment. The shape of that curve should be familiar to you. It's one we've talked about before. It indicates the number of connections in a region of brain over time. These are young animals, and we see what we talked about before, overproduction and pruning back of connections in the brains of both groups of animals. Importantly, though, there are differences in the magnitude of connection production in the group that was reared in the complex environment. Across the developmental period, environment makes a big difference. Animals in the enriched environment create more synapses earlier, and they maintain that advantage across development. What this suggests is that there are environmental effects in the brain that extend across this period of childhood. Interestingly, and probably importantly for all of you out there, myself included, Bill's study suggests that these kinds of effects, that is, the effects of complexity and interest in the environment, are not confined to the early period of development. When we look at the data from adults, we should all be very happy here to see what's going on here. The adults, like the young animals, show significant effect of exposure to the complex environment. Learning is a lifelong event. Learning must have a biological basis, a neurobiological basis. And these data suggest that at least some kinds of brain changes can persist well into adulthood, suggesting that there is a role of enriching your experience throughout the lifespan. These kinds of data suggest that experience can induce more connections within the brain, but there are other data that suggest that experience can alter brain organization as well. So here we've just seen kind of an increase in the number of connections in the brain that's related to the complexity and interest of the experience that an organism has. But there's also evidence that experience can alter the organization of the brain. So there are two examples I'd like to talk about. These are the last two examples I'll be talking about tonight. One looks at the effects of hearing loss in congenital hearing loss. It looks at the effects of what happens to brain areas when someone is born deaf. The second is work from our laboratory at UCSD looking at the effects of prenatal brain injury on the development of both behavior and organization of the brain. So let's begin by looking at the effects of early hearing loss. Some children are born with a malformation of the cochlea, that is a sensory organ that transmits sound information to the brain. These children never experience sound. Yet, as we've seen there earlier when we were talking about brain areas, there are regions of the brain whose primary function it is to process auditory information, to process that the information that you hear. What happens to those brain regions in children who never experience sound? Do they simply go unused? Do they atrophy? Do they go away? Or are they recruited to serve different functions? Functional brain imaging studies have provided answers to these basic questions. This study comes from the laboratory of Karen Dopkins in the psychology department at UCSD. She used functional magnetic resonance imaging, fMRI, to look at the brains of both normal and congenitally deaf individuals. While their brains were being imaged, there's a way of detecting what areas of the brain are active while a subject is engaged in a particular task. While these individuals were being imaged, hearing subjects were given an auditory task to do. So they were asked to listen to something and make a response. The congenitally deaf individuals were asked to look at something and make a response. So the hearing subjects were doing a hearing task. The deaf subjects were doing a visual task. These data show the brain activation from these two groups. Specifically, the areas that you see there in green, first of all, the areas that you see there in green correspond to the primary auditory areas that we talked about earlier. As you see in the small brain, the orange spot with crosshairs through it, that's primary auditory cortex, and that's what you're looking at in these other views of the brain. What you see here, the green areas correspond to the activation in auditory cortex for hearing subjects. So they're hearing something, their auditory cortex activates. That's reasonable. What's remarkable about this study is that the orange marks that you see here and here is the activation that was observed among deaf individuals when they were participating in a visual task. So what these data suggest is that there has been a change in function, that an area that in the normal course of development, had these individuals not lost their hearing, this region of the brain would have become primary auditory cortex, the primary hearing area of the brain. But in these individuals who never heard anything, they had no use for such a thing, such a brain structure. So it became a visual structure for them, a structure of the brain that could process visual information. Now, how did this change in functional organization of this area of cortex come about? First, unlike the effects of the enriched environment, this kind of brain change, change in brain organization, only happens when deafness occurs very, very early. If someone became deaf as an adult, you would not see this kind of change. This is an effect of the plasticity of the developing brain, a change in brain area. Now, why has it happened? Recall that some of the connections in the brain are overproduced early in development. Then, due to competition for resources in particular brain areas, the best and most active connections stabilize and become a permanent part of the information processing network, while the less efficient connections are pruned away. Early in development, normally transient connections form between the eye and the auditory cortex. These are usually pruned back because they're not as efficient as the connections between the ear and the auditory cortex. In the case of congenital deafness, the competition in auditory cortex is altered. There is no competition coming from the ear in these individuals. And the normally transient connections from the eye stabilize and redefine the function of the normally auditory cortex into a visual area. These findings show that the final functional organization of brain areas depends in large measure on the experience of the individual. Deaf people do not have a use for the normal auditory cortex, and instead it becomes reorganized to serve a visual function. These studies, by the way, have been done with other modalities. There's evidence that in blind individuals, within primary auditory cortex, if you do these kinds of functional imaging studies, you see responsivity when they're reading Braille, for example. So many different kinds of studies of that sort. The final example that I'd like to present tonight concerns the effect of very early brain injury on development. If a child has a stroke in the prenatal period, that is, before he or she is born, what happens to their development? Is the child able to acquire abilities that would normally have been carried out by the brain areas that were damaged, or are they permanently impaired? To illustrate this question, I'd like to focus on the development of language in a child. I'm just going to present one case study. She represents the larger population that we study, but the point is illustrated with one child. But I'd like to focus on the language development in a child who had a prenatal stroke that damaged all of the major language areas as defined in the adult brain. To understand what happens during development in a child with an early stroke, let's first consider what happens to an adult. That is, what is the effect of significant damage to the brain's language areas if you have a stroke when you're an adult? Okay, first let's take a closer look at the major speech areas of the brain. This is the left hemisphere, important because in almost all individuals, language is predominantly a left hemisphere function. The major language areas in the adult brain within the left hemisphere are two. There is an area in frontal regions that is important for expressive speech. We talked about this before, for speech production. There is a second area in, further back in the brain that's important for the, for comprehension of speech. There are also important pathways that connect these two regions. So this whole expanse between these two regions is an important language processing area. So what happens when the main language areas are destroyed by a stroke? I'm going to play for you an example of the language, the speech of a man who suffered a stroke that affected a significant portion of the language areas in the brain, those areas that I just showed you. His injuries were particularly bad in the more frontal regions in the speech production areas. His diagnosis was that of an expressive aphasic. An aphasic is a patient who has difficulties with language. He's also called a Broca's aphasic after the 19th century French neurologist who first identified the association between this region of cortex and expressive language problems. The segment I'm going to show you uses a standard neuropsychological assessment measure called the cookie theft. Okay, what you see here is the cookie, the picture that's used in the cookie theft. It's a standard picture. And what the patient is asked to do is to tell the neuropsychologist everything he can about what's happening in the picture. The task provides an opportunity to evaluate the patient's language impairments, and you'll see that this patient has considerable difficulty with speech production. By the way, his deficit is a permanent one. Okay.
Tell me everything you see going on in this picture.
Okay. Gore. Boy and good girl and the girl and ball. Down the stool. Mother and distress.
Okay. You can see from this example that injury to the major language areas of the brain during adulthood leads to serious language problems. I want to thank Dr. Dan Kempler from Emerson University in Boston for providing that tape, by the way. But the question is, what if there is similar injury that occurs early in development? Can the developing brain organize differently in order to preserve this important ability in childhood? That is, does the developing brain exhibit plasticity? The case I'm going to talk to you about is part of an ongoing longitudinal study, that is, of children with prenatal stroke. We identify these children as early as we can, often in the first year of life, and follow them for as long as we can through childhood. So we truly study their development over time. It is a study that involves many, many people. In the example that I'm going to show here, the responsibility for all of the work having to do with language really lies with my colleagues on this project. These colleagues include Judy Riley and Beverly Wolfeck from San Diego State University, Elizabeth Bates from UCSD, and Christina Sockerman from Università Vita Salute San Rafael in Milan. Christina used to be a graduate student with us. Okay. These are MRI images, structural brain images, from a child that had a stroke during the prenatal period. It affected all of her major language areas, that is the language areas that would have become language areas in an adult. You can see the injury over here on the left side of the brain. There's significant loss of white matter on this side of the brain compared to this side of the brain, and also the deep gray matter structures. She's also lost a significant amount of cortex within these cortical regions. She has some left, but it's suffered considerable damage. And the neuroradiologist report is that both Broca's and both the expressive language and the comprehension areas have been compromised. This child, her history, we follow them longitudinally, so we know what her language acquisition was like. This child was extremely delayed in language. At age 2.5, she had no productive language. She did not talk at all. She was beginning to talk by the time she was 3. That's very late. Most children begin to talk sometime during the second year of life. But interestingly, by age 5, she'd made considerable progress. By age 5, she began to test within the normal range when we use standardized tests of language. And by age 6, her language was well within the normal range. And what I'd like to do is I'd like you to listen to this child when she was 6 years of age. This is a child with a very large stroke, with compromise to all of the major language areas of the brain, delayed in language acquisition, and yet listen to what her speech was like when she was 6. Okay. The measure that we use in order to obtain the language sample is a little like the cookie theft. We use a wordless picture book that was done years ago by Mercer Mayer. It's called Frog, Where Are You? What we do is we ask the children, let them look at the story so they have a sense of what the book is about, and then we ask them to tell the story. It's a story of a boy, a dog, and his vagabond frog friend. Okay, so they tell us a story going page by page, and that way we're able to obtain a significant language sample from them. So what I'm going to do is give you a short sample of her language as she was telling the story.
The dog is looking in the frog bowl. In the night, when the girl is sleeping, the frog jumped out of its bowl. What's the boy instead? When the boy woke up next morning, he looked at the frog was gone. Then the boy was looking at his hat, and the dog was going in the frog bowl. Then he looked outside the window, and the dog had the bowl on his head. Then the dog jumped out with the bowl on his head.
Okay, you can hear from this narrative that this child's expressive language is quite good. She's completely age-appropriate. Other testing shows that her speech comprehension is also well within the normal range. So although the injury to this child's brain was comparable to the injury that we saw in the adult aphasic, the child was able to compensate for the effects of her injury in a way that the adult was not. The question is, how did she do this? Was she able to recruit kind of atypical brain areas to help her with this important task? In a recent study by Beverly Wolfeck and Christina Sockerman, we were able to look to see what parts of the brain this child activates when she's engaged in a language task. This study was done when this child was 10 years old, so this is a few years after the language sample that you heard. What we asked individuals to do is to perform in a language task while they're having their brain functionally imaged, at the MRI center. The task is a simple one. The individuals are shown 2 pictures, like the ones you see here, and basically they're asked who did what to whom. So the 2 pictures come up, then there is an auditory sentence that they hear. It says, the cow is pushing the elephant, and what they're to do is to respond by pushing one button if they think the cow did it, and the other button if they think the elephant did it. Okay, this task was given to subjects while their brains were being imaged using fMRI and in order to see what areas of the brain were active. Let's look first at the brain activation patterns in typical adults and typical 10-year-old children. Okay, so there we on the left, what you see is the typical activation patterns for the adults, top and bottom picture, and in the middle you see typical children. What you see in this small inset are the slices that you're looking at. So if we took this brain and we cut it this way at the 2 levels that you see indicated there, at the bottom slides indicate the lower cut, the top slides indicate the upper cut. One of the things that you should notice is that when we look at these lower 2 slices, what we are looking at are 2 of the major language areas of the brain. You'll notice this yellow line goes through both the expressive area and the production area. Now, this was primarily a language comprehension task. You listen to something and interpret it. And so it's probably not surprising that these comprehension areas of the brain showed a lot of activation. But we also see some activation in the production areas further forward in the brain. So all of the major language areas are engaged. Also notice up here that there is, in both the adults and children, another area that's active. This is somewhat outside the typical language areas, but this is an area that is typically involved in verbal working memory. So it's a verbal memory area. So these are the patterns for typical adults and children. What does the activation look like in this child that we've just been listening to? Okay. So here are her activation data. First notice that she also activates the limited tissue that she has available in the traditional language area. So like the normal children and like the adults, she is activating what's left of this normal comprehension area. However, notice that she has also recruited a considerable amount of brain within the right hemisphere. So she activates what's left of the language areas, typical language areas in the left hemisphere, but also recruits these additional right hemisphere resources. And notice that we really didn't see anything activating in these more frontal regions in this child. These activation data suggest that this child's brain has organized differently in the aftermath of her early brain injury. Language is an important function. And unlike her adult counterparts, this child was able to recruit alternative brain areas to support this essential function. This demonstrates the plasticity of the developing brain, that is, the capacity to organize differently, in this case, to support the needs of the child. Okay, then, so what does all of this tell us about brain development? First, as I've been saying all the way through this lecture, the human brain is a complex structure that develops over a very long period of time, from about 20 days into gestation, all the way through adolescence, and arguably there are changes that go on through adulthood. Normal brain development requires both genes and the environment interacting in concert in order to achieve the kind of structural and functional organization that we've seen. Brain development is flexible and dynamic. Genetic cues set up the basic patterns of organization, and input from the environment serves to sculpt and shape the functional complexity of the circuitry to meet the needs of the developing child. Brain development is flexible. It adapts to the demands of the world. One topic we didn't discuss at length, mostly because the examples are really complicated and hard to explain, is the fact that genetic cues and external input can interact directly and influence each other. So there can be experiences that can trigger gene expression, things like that. In short, brain development is 100% the product of nature and 100% the product of nurture, interacting throughout development to produce the amazing biological structure that is the human brain. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this and other UCTV programs, visit us online at www.uctv.tv.